Agents of Cool, Season 2, in color.
Welcome back to Agents of Cool. With this episode, we begin our season 2, and we've got some really exciting plans, all kinds of cool stuff we're going to cover for you this time. This particular year, we don't have as many spy movies on the calendar, so we're going to be pursuing various episode reviews and book reviews and movie reviews, doing some deep cuts this year, because we think we'll enjoy them, and we think if we share them with you, you'll enjoy them too. I'm Eric. I'm your grumpy ass number 6 sitting over in the corner here to remind you, as always, that just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you.
I'm Ray. I run the board, do the sound effects, and hey, we do have that Brother Grimsby movie coming out.
You know, I think I'd rather saw off my own foot.
We went to see the...
Spy was a good movie. With the adorable Melissa McCarthy.
We went to see a Mark Millar movie.
Yeah, but it had been filtered through the sensibilities of Matthew Vaughn.
Mark Millar got some of my money.
Only a very small amount, relatively speaking.
It's the principle of the matter. Well,
Dave Gibbons got some of your money, too. You see, I look at Sacha Baron Cohen and I want to smash his face with a brick.
I think that's the character he's playing. Hey, it's got Mark Strong.
Mark Strong's a jinx. Have you noticed that?
What do you mean?
Mark Strong's a jinx. Green Lantern, bomb. John Carter, bomb.
Well, okay, Green Lantern bomb because it was just meh. And
true.
John Carter bomb because apparently Disney didn't know how to promote a movie with a princess in it.
Which is, I've got a more sinister conspiracy theory about that. I think by the time they were planning Carter's advertising campaign, they already knew they were buying Star Wars.
Oh.
And they didn't feel the need to really push John Carter because they knew they had the boy market wrapped up with Star Wars as soon as that got on its feet.
Interesting.
So there's no point. Yeah, they took a huge write down on Carter, but there's no point in going out there and spending a bunch of money to promote that, even though you're going to take a huge write-down on it, even though you're spending $4 billion for Lucasfilm, because, hell, Force Awakens has already cleared $2 billion.
That's an interesting...
That's half the purchase price for Lucasfilm. There's no point in getting worked up about that, because you know you're going to have your space movie wrapped up with Star Wars anyway.
That's interesting, because that's... Okay, that's
it makes
interesting...
It makes me a little sick to my stomach to think about it, because there's no reason we can't have 3 or 4 John Carter movies and 3 or 4 Star Wars movies and do the whole schmear with all of it. There's no reason we could not have had all these things, except, of course, we're all too familiar with the limited points of view of the average studio executive.
Well, okay, I'm not sure that makes me feel better or worse.
Makes me feel worse, actually.
Really?
Okay. It kind of does.
In fact, at least was an intelligent, well, you know, there's at least a more intelligent and slightly less personal, okay, I'm going to basically shiv this guy's projects in so that, you know, because they weren't my idea versus... We got the cool hotness coming in. What the hell do we need to do this John Carter thing for?
Let's just give them a standard advertising package. Was there a Happy Meal tie-in? No. Kids' books promoted in libraries? Were there advertisements on Disney XD? Where was the toy line? I mean, where is all the promotional stuff they do?
The lack of die-cast flying ships is a particular aggravation of mine. And there is not a stuffed plush Woola on my shelf.
Exactly.
It is not
they had toys.
I don't want a stuffed plush Woola. Do we want a stuffed plush Woola?
We want a stuffed plush Woola.
You see, there should have been all that stuff. They had the toys for Zootopia out 2 months ago. And that's out and that's cleaning up. And Zootopia's been, they properly advertised Zootopia months ago. They started building up to that. I mean, look at the way they run their advertising for everything else. And John Carter got some TV commercials, maybe a couple of billboards in L.A., and that was it. None of the merchandising blitz that usually accompanies a Disney movie. I mean, even people who don't watch Star Wars knew Star Wars was coming a year before it came out.
Well, that's because, if nothing else, they got how many bazillion column inches out of Disney just bought Lucasfilm?
Yeah.
Mic drop.
Exactly. But they didn't do any of that. I mean,
we thought when they bought Marvel, we thought that was like, oh my God, brain explosion. No, that was just pocket change.
Stacey, do you remember one ad from the creator of Tarzan, John Carter of Mars?
No.
Nothing like that. Do you remember an ad from the creator of Finding Dory and WALL-E? From the creators of WALL-E and Tarzan? Because it was Andrew Stanton that did Nemo.
I remember
that.
Did
you see any of that?
I remember one. I thought there was one or two where they did, you know, the JCB things, but it was not enough to make you figure out. It didn't mention Mars. It didn't really... It was like they were trying to do the mystery, you know, get people interested trailer, but it was just like it left people confused.
Now this could just be mendacious mismanagement. It could just be that they're morons and have no idea how to advertise this. This is possible, but where's Lynn Collins, where's the Maxim magazine cover with Lynn Collins in her Deja Thoris costume?
But that's the thing, okay.
Where's the GQ cover with the fabulous babe?
Disney knows how to market things. Disney...
Exactly. They know how to market things. I mean, more than anything else, they're insidious about it.
Well, the one thing they know more than how to market things is to basically how to convince Congress to extend the copyright limits.
Exactly.
Which I guess is its own special form of marketing in a very niche, you know, very niche audience. But still, you know, Disney, you know, no, that's the thing why, you know, I just assume basically it was the, you know, once, you know, the incoming, you know, studio exec ganking the project of the outgoing studio exec.
It could be that. Although I don't think there was any executive shuffle going on at the time.
I thought there was a change at one level.
You may be right. I'd have to double check it. I don't remember, you know, for sure. You could be right.
I mean, you know, the trade pubs are filled with, you know, tales of all sorts of, you know, various goings.
Chicanery.
Yeah. Well, I mean, okay. Look at the various, I mean, for the love of God, and unless you think we're making these up, go back for episodes about, like, particularly our Spectre episode and the sheer level of back and forth and, you know, war to the knife lawsuits and such over Spectre and, you know, it nearly derailed the James Bond franchise.
Exactly, which has basically been a license to print money for the last 50 years, which is, in a way, why people fight about it, why there's lawsuits. Because if you get to do this, if you're doing it at all, you're going to get rich. And if you do it right, you're going to get even richer. So, Ray, our resident Q, and Stacy.
Hi, I'm Stacy, our third host. It might surprise you to know that I often try to keep these guys on topic and on schedule.
Or maybe that wouldn't surprise people at all. That really wouldn't surprise people at all. Unfortunately, we must begin season two on a slightly more, on a really mournful note. We must add another star to the memorial wall at Agents of Cool headquarters as we note the passing of Sir Ken Adam. He died this past week at the age of 95 as we record. Sir Ken Adam was the production designer for many of the classic Sean Connery and Roger Moore James Bond films. If you close your eyes and picture the Fort Knox set or the laser beam room from Goldfinger, or if you picture the volcano lair and You Only Live Twice, or if you're imagining the submarine pen and The Spy Who Loved Me, or the space shuttles and the space stations in Moonraker, or any of a dozen other beautiful, extraordinary cinematic sets, then you have reveled in the work of Ken Adam in film. Of course, James Bond's only a small portion of his filmography. He also worked for Stanley Kubrick. He worked on one of the Adams Family movies. IMDb, the guy's name, and it's a list of really extraordinary credits. Again, check this guy out. We don't want to spend, you know, too much time bringing you down at the start of the show, but he was a remarkable presence. He was, if you watch any of the behind the scenes on the related Bond films, he's a colorful raconteur, a wonderful gentleman to listen to, and he was a genius production designer. He set the standard for not just spy movies, but maybe movies in general. He was really a remarkably talented man, and he will be desperately missed. So rest easy, Sir Ken Adam, and as we noted last year, upon the passing of Leonard Nimoy and Sir Patrick McNee, we kind of hope someone somewhere is producing one hell of a spy movie, which is why we're losing so many of these cool guys in such rapid succession. Moving on, you may recall last year, although it didn't make a dent at the U.S. box office, there was a film version of the classic 60s television series, The Man from U.N.C.L.E. And if you are a listener, longtime listener to Agents of Cool, you may recall our glowing review of the film. We're huge supporters of that movie around here. We think it was a wonderful movie, hugely entertaining, well-photographed, well-directed, well-written, the whole nine yards.
Well-scored, excellent music. Excellent music.
I mean, the clothes, the locations, it looked like it was filmed in Italy in 1963. Wonderful movie, hugely entertaining. So we think to ourselves, why don't we go back and look at the first episode of Man from U.N.C.L.E., the television show, the classic television show from the 1960s that served as the inspiration for the recent film. Is this one of those things where you can go back and watch the movie and then roll into the TV show and have it feel like they are of a piece? Are the characters the same? Is the world the same? Or is this one of those things where they just took the source material and twisted it into whatever thing they wanted to do? Or is it somewhere in between? So we have, right before recording this, we have watched the first episode of The Man from U.N.C.L.E. from 1963.
64.
Was it 64?
It was 64. September 22nd, 1964.
They shot the pilot in 63 and then they started. Okay. It aired in 1964, the same year that Goldfinger came out. Now, a little bit of backstory. Again, we're going to reference the book Spy Television by Wesley Britton, which if you're a fan of this material, you really need to go get that book on Amazon or at your local public library. Spy Television tells me that the producer, Norman Felton, this would be sometime in 1962, was trying to think, well, what kind of TV show can I do? That's not a Western, that's not a doctor show, that's not a lawyer show. And he thinks, aha, I'll do a spy show. And he has a meeting in New York with, of all people, and of course, naturally, Ian Fleming. So Norman Felton meets with Ian Fleming, and they're knocking ideas around, and they're talking about stuff. And the name Napoleon Solo, the lead character of The Man from U.N.C.L.E., perhaps the Man from U.N.C.L.E. of the title, the name Napoleon Solo was contributed by no less than Ian Fleming himself. And then Norman Felton flies back to Los Angeles, and he recruits a writer named Sam Roth. Sam Roth, whom I think created the classic Western Have Gun, Will Travel. Mm-hmm. And so Sam Roth takes Felton's and Fleming's ideas and starts working them into a series. Now, according, again, to Spy Television, Cubby Broccoli and Harry Saltzman, the producers of the Bond films in those days, sort of lean on Ian Fleming a little bit to avoid any kind of legal entanglements or any kind of conflict of interest. They say, Mr. Fleming, we need you to step back here. And Mr. Fleming, who's in ill health at that time and needs a little less pressure in his life, happily does. And then Felton and Roth start kneading and massaging their idea into something that captures the flavor of an international spy drama, but maybe is a little less Bond.
We should pause here and, you know, note the irony of them asking him to, let's kind of not be involved much with this Man from U.N.C.L.E. thing, because there might be some, you know, legal fallout and ramifications, some headaches we don't need.
Oh, and they're right about that. Because, you know, of course, they're dogged by lawsuits from Mr. McClory for decades. So I guess it's wise of them. They're trying to avoid as few of that.
I suppose there could have been two sets of competing cases. But...
at which, thank God, there was just the one. So initially the title of the show was going to be Solo. But again, they were getting some pressure from EM Productions that Solo was actually the name of a gangster in Goldfinger. And so they wanted to make it a little bit different. And I think it was NBC, the network, that contributed to the title The Man from U.N.C.L.E., which initially I think Felton and Roth didn't really care for because it made it sound like a family show or something. Something a little softer than they actually intended. So what you end up with is a television show about the Man from U.N.C.L.E., Napoleon Solo, secret agent, spy, working for the United Network Command for Law and Enforcement. And believe it or not, they actually got a little grief from the United Nations about that, because the United Nations apparently didn't want to be associated with your silly little spy TV show.
Right, well, then there was apparently, they initially wanted it to just be left, the acronym to be left unstated.
Exactly.
So, you know, exactly. Was it the UN? Was it some other shouty organization? What was it? Who knows?
Until the UN apparently threw a fit about it.
No sense of humor. They get the Doctor Who guys black about that,
too. Yeah, they've really got no sense of humor over there.
I mean, it's like, and admittedly, okay, later Doctor Who unit is kind of a lot more grayer, you know, post 9/11, good, bad. Yeah, so maybe I can understand. But, you know, original unit was pretty much saving the world from aliens. How could you not want to be associated with that?
Pretty much straight up, stiff upper lip, British hero saving the day against alien invasions with the help of a slightly wacky alien. Yeah, I'm good with that.
Yeah, and they were seemingly okay with it being the United Nations. I think it was Intelligence Task Force back
right,
then.
Or at least nobody at the UN noticed this little niche TV show. Let's be fair, a lot of people didn't notice the little TV show, and yet they were very sad when it was gone, but I don't know that it made it all the way to Turtle Bay.
And then it came back, finally. So, Man from U.N.C.L.E. One of the things they're pursuing in the format of the series is the idea that someone from outside the world of espionage, this is apparently the thing that distinguishes U.N.C.L.E. from Bond in particular, is that it brings a regular person into the spy world. That it's about the point of view of regular housewives or secretaries or school teachers. Apparently, it was usually a female guest star. Male guest stars were incredibly rare, unless you were William Shatner. There's an episode we need to review where they had William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy 2 years before they were on Star Trek. We desperately got to review that show. But anyway, so we're looking at the first episode of the TV show, some rough idea of its development. So what did we think? Well, we loved the movie. We're all on record. We loved the movie. Yeah. Stacey, what did you think of the TV show?
It was, I don't know, I mean, the of course, as we talked about earlier, the show became somewhat more humorous over time under the influence of competing shows like the 60s Batman. So maybe the movie was picking up on some of that as well. But the movie seemed to maybe be a little bit more self-aware.
Lighthearted?
I don't know. I guess so. There was a bit of a smirk to Solo's personality that they didn't quite seem to have here. But
there were flashes of that.
He would occasionally try to do the "Hi, I'm charming and I sleep with all the women" thing, but it just didn't quite come across quite the same. But.
Well, I think partly because they had to do a bit more of a nod and a wink to get it on the air back in the 60s than, say, what we got in Man from U.N.C.L.E.
That's fair.
And or, you know, even if, I guess maybe a few years later, I suspect Bond probably opened a number of doors in terms of
acceptability of content.
Or just, you know, basically like, okay, we want to be even more like this. Because remember, this is before Goldfinger, which was, to pardon the phrase, like an atom bomb going off.
Exactly. So it worked out to the benefit of the show that Goldfinger basically is in theaters, not exactly, but in the same period, in the same time, in the same season as Man from U.N.C.L.E. went on the air. So these things all kind of, it was kind of the perfect storm in a way.
Well, I think the public really, you know, I think the public was ripe for spy stories. The first two Bond movies had done fairly well. Secret Agent / Danger Man was popular on both sides of the pond. Mm-hmm. I mean, Bond, you just hit that zeitgeist at the exact moment. It was a spectacularly well-made, I mean, Goldfinger, go back to our first episode. If you want our thoughts on Goldfinger, we pretty much unpacked it for damn near two hours.
Yeah. It's a good episode, by the way.
So, it, you know, it wasn't just like they weren't riding the coattails. In a sense, they created the coattails, but there was a large amount of interest in popular media, you know, the public for stories of that kind. So, you know, this was a matter of hitting the exact moment and working with it, but also, you know, putting their own spin on it. So, I mean, it was, you know, Bond was successful, so that meant, okay, we want more stuff like this. And it just, they kind of fed on each other.
Right show, right place, right time.
Right.
Okay, so Ray, did you like the show?
I liked it quite a bit. This was the pilot episode as
right.
well. Right.
This was the pilot.
So the one thing I always like to watch, you know, multiple episodes of a show well past the pilot, just because the first few episodes, the actors are trying to get a feel for the characters, the writers are trying to get a feel for the characters. I mean, look at Mission Impossible, first couple of season, you know, first couple of episodes versus the later ones, or look at some of the early season two stuff with, you know, Jim Phelps versus some of the later stuff. There are slight, you know, there's subtle differences there. The characters are, you know, the actors are more comfortable with the characters. The writers have a better idea of what the characters would or wouldn't do. Yeah, for example, this one, we see Ilya Kuryakin in this one.
He could just as easily be another flunky Uncle Ben.
If it wasn't for the co-starring thing, it's like, okay, this guy kind of important there. Now,
that struck me as odd for this being, especially if it was also the pilot. Though, as we discussed before we went on the air, there was some question of whether Ilya was supposed to be as important to the show as he ended up being, hence the singular man from Uncle in the title.
Well, I mean, the other thing also about
men, but it's a little odd that they would have that character and not. Did they even name him in?
Yeah, they called him Ilya.
They did call him Ilya.
Yeah. Okay. No, it is my understanding that Ilya became more important to the show than he was originally intended, but he was originally intended to be a relatively important part of the show.
Okay, so it just seems odd that in not only the first episode to air, but also the one that they showed off to show what the show was like, that the secondary character would be in one scene.
Well, I mean, the goal of a pilot is, okay, boom, here's the pilot, and you show it to your TV executives, and if you get them sufficiently drunk and they all nod their heads, then they will cut you a big check and you get to make more. And if not, you just spent a whole bunch of your money and got bupkis. So they may have wanted to keep it somewhat streamlined to just keep the number of characters and plot threads to keep track of fairly straightforward, because it's got a couple twists in there. It's not okay. It's not Mission Impossible grade twistiness. Okay, you can pretty much follow this if you have to look off for a second or, you know, whatnot. This isn't, you need to be watching every single second of this or you're lost.
But there are a couple moments. There's a really good dun 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 moment in the pilot.
Now, one nice thing about it is it does, for your dun 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 moments, it also then nicely breaks to commercial. Part of that is, I think, is, you know, that's to get people to come back because you've all of a sudden had this little mini cliffhanger and now we're going to sell some soap and then you're going to stay tuned in until they get done selling you the soap. So, but, you know, so it had a couple twists there, so I could see them maybe wanting to keep it somewhat simple and straightforward, and it's got a neat opening. I mean, you all of a sudden you're immediately pulled in because all of a sudden there's these guys running this op, and then, you know, you all of a sudden you're inside the base, and then you've got that great shot of the shooting at Robert Vaughn, and then it's bulletproof glass, and then, you know, illuminated, and the man from Uncle, and you kind of want to know, who is this guy? Who are these nameless assassins trying to kill him? Why is there this, you know, stainless steel corridor office with guys carrying guns?
Sleek, ultra-modern, hidden spy base in the middle of New York.
Behind, like a dry cleaner. So, you know, there's a certain amount of...
That was the thing. Another thing that surprised me for this being the first episode is that I had read about the Del Floria's tailor shop thing as the entrance to Uncle Headquarters. So the fact that in the very first episode, they subverted the standard, like, actual Uncle Agent going in there. There hadn't been a standard yet, and you end up with assassins going
right,
in
but
there.
Right, but I think, yeah, that struck me as kind of weird, because I'm like, wait, they're burning the secret, you know, they're burning the entrance to the secret base, or it's not going to be the, you know, maybe they'll use a different business for later shows. But actually, for a pilot, it was kind of neat, because, okay, one of the things about, like, the Bond movies, the early ones, is, you know, they kind of talk through the gadgets a bit, okay? It's like, you know, here's the gadget. And the later ones, they maybe allude to it a little bit, but part of the fun is not knowing that gadget is there. You know, Bond's got something up his sleeve. Or we explain all the gadgets and you're waiting for Bond to use it, or it's a gadget you didn't know Bond had. Mm-hmm. And they're kind of, it's, you know, kind of Chekhov's laser watch. It's kind of, he's got the laser watch, when is he going to use it, kind of thing. So, or you don't know he had that, and you think, okay, they're in deep soup, and then all of a sudden he pulls, you know, that little widget out of there. They could have just done, okay, here's the base, and they'll go through and got the briefing and such, and that would have been okay, but this immediately pulls you in. You go right into this action sequence. These two guys, you know, they overpower the base guards and, you know, look like they're getting in there and basically...
Moneypenny would have never let that happen, by the way. Moneypenny would have shot him dead.
Well,
that's second thought.
She would have hit the alarm button as soon as the guy put the jacket over the TV monitor. Yeah, that would have been like, a, you know, something ain't right here. But the thing is, it gives you this action sequence, and you know, who are these nameless? I mean, they're obviously shooting their way in and bypassing the security, and they're trying to burn through the door, and alarms are going off, and you know, who are these people? What is this facility? What's going on? Are these the good guys? Are these the bad guys?
Right. Okay. Thinking about it from that point of view, that these, whereas I was surprised because I knew that, you know, going in through Del Floria's was a common thing in The Man from U.N.C.L.E. But thinking about this as the first time you ever, your first exposure to this show at all, and that's the first thing you see is these guys going into a tailor shop, and all of a sudden it turns into crazy spy headquarters, and they're shooting at bulletproof glass, and there's this guy ducking and dodging and shooting them back. And
yeah, and then it's like, you know, no fingerprints, no ID. You know,
they don't have fingerprints.
It's just like
their fingerprints have been surgically removed.
The opposition is already onto our heroes and is this mysterious organization that has resources apparently comparable to the good guys. So it's kind of like, okay.
You're dropped in the middle of the conflict. This is not an origin story. Here's our good guys. Here's our bad guys. Mm-hmm. Crap is happening. Get with the program.
They do mention that at this point they don't know what the word thrush actually refers to, whether right. That's the name of the leader or the organization.
Could be a man, could be a woman, could be a committee.
So, but there is a villain, and we know there is a villain, and we know they're out there. So I kind of like it this way. Here's what's going on. Let's get caught up and just keep moving. So, not as handsomely mounted as the first episode of Mission Impossible. But then, there are actually not a lot of movies these days that are as handsomely mounted as the episode, as the first episode of Mission Impossible. Well,
they spent a lot more on that first episode of Mission Impossible.
They did.
And it, you know, was made a little bit later, and you know, it was filmed in color from the get-go. I mean, for those of you who are going out there and are getting Man from U.N.C.L.E. on Netflix or whoever it is, don't adjust your sets. First season is in black and white.
And it's, but for all that, this is still a very slick, very stylish, very well-produced piece of television. Little wonder that a network executive would have watched this and said, well, let's get some more of those.
Yeah, and again, that opener as a pilot, it pulls you in. You want to know more. And again, it's got, black and white, it's got some great shots in it. I mean, you know, the starred glass with Napoleon Stello standing behind, you know, all of a sudden.
Oh, that introduction backlit to the main character is wonderful.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, that just pulls you in. You want to, you know, says the man, you know, Man from U.N.C.L.E., then it cuts to, and it's like, okay, who is this person? Why are they trying to kill him? What's going on? I mean, it really does do a great job pulling you in.
And it is somewhat subversive for its day and age. The guys breaking into the tailor shop, they're not Russians. They're not Chinese. They're not identifiably.
They don't say a
political
word.
They're not identifiably political in any way. When the hero turns to this guy in the superhero secret spy base, guy's Russian. Guy's a Russian. This is kind of subversive because there's a lot of other shows in 1964 where the bad guy would have been the Russian. But he's on the side of the angels in this one.
Wasn't there also a black guy at the desk that they overpowered?
There was, exactly.
So U.N.C.L.E.'s already diverse.
Already relatively diverse, especially by the standards of 60s television. Now, Star Trek.
Pre-Star Trek TOS.
This is pre-Star Trek, the original series, right? So 2 years in advance of Star Trek, first episode of Man from U.N.C.L.E., the hero, the American, is working with a Russian against a greater enemy. This is, I mean, it's one of the things where a lot of people would have dismissed this as just silly escapist entertainment. But right there in the first episode is a fairly powerful statement about we're working together. In a day and an age where that wasn't at all the expected thing.
Yeah, I remember that period in the mid to late 80s where every other movie was about we have to team up with the Russians now. Usually a sequel to a previous movie where we were not teaming up with the Russians. But yeah, apparently we were already doing that in 1963.
They really should have done a Rocky V where like Rocky has to team up with Ivan Drago against the Predator.
I'm honestly surprised they didn't do that.
They really should have done that. I would have paid so much money to see that movie. I would pay that much to see it even now.
2010, one of the many Iron Eagle movies was about teaming up with the Russians. There are all kinds of movies about teaming up.
Didn't Drago punch Apollo Creed to death in the ring?
That's fair.
He did.
I don't think you team up with the guy who punched your friend to death in the ring.
Yeah, but you see, in the first part of Rocky V, he comes they're put together by their respective governments because there's a greater menace, and Ivan Drago would have eventually sacrificed himself to save Rocky in the course of the movie, thereby redeeming himself in the eyes of both Rocky and the audience.
I think it should have opened with Rocky continuing to punch him more in the face.
Yeah, but you see, he's been called on a mission by his own government. He's holding back the violent torrent of vengeful emotions that he's... You see, that's where we see that Stallone can really act, because he's holding back in this hypothetical Rocky V the violent, vengeful emotions, and you see the pain in his face as he struggles to work for the greater common good with this avowed enemy who took his friend from him. And then, of course, in the back half of the movie, he sacrifices himself to save Rocky, and maybe Rocky reevaluates Drago's character.
Stuff got made in the 80s. I'm saying
you right now you want to see this movie. I wish I could make this movie happen. I can't, but I wish I could.
We're up from rental to matinee.
It's like an international, an interstellar thing where like an alien species comes down to Earth and says, "We challenge your greatest warriors to one-on-one combat." And of course, the greatest
because it has to be a boxing movie.
It has to be a boxing movie, right? So for the fate of your world, we ask you to commit your greatest warriors to this contest. And of course, the Americans pick Rocky Balboa, and the Russians pick, even though he was defeated by Rocky in the end of Rocky IV, the Russians pick Ivan Drago, because even though he lost, he still beat Apollo Creed, right? Ivan Drago's still their best. So Drago's motivated by his desperate need to redeem himself in the eyes of his government and his people, and Rocky's motivated by the need to defend the planet Earth, of course. And then there's a subtle subplot in here, and you see him talking with Adrian and like Polly about this. I just want to kill the guy, Adrian. And you see him like, and you see Stallone really digging into the part there.
Or the scenery, as the case
and Rocky, and Rocky V is probably directed by John Glenn, the guy that did the latter Roger Moore and Timothy Dalton James Bond movies. So yeah, totally. You would see this movie right now. And then probably, who's the alien's trainer? Who would be the alien's trainer? Oh, who would be the... Someone's got to be the alien's trainer on the other side of the
ring. I guess if you're going for the...
Who would the alien's trainer
be? I guess if it's going to be a Burgess Meredith next, you'd go with E.T. or something? I mean...
No. It needs to be
lots
like...
Lots of wrinkles?
There's got to be like a really good 80s character actor who could be like the Predator's trainer over in the Predator's corner. Who would it be? Hackman, maybe? No, Hackman would never act under the makeup. Who would it be?
I'm
pretty far down the rabbit hole.
I don't think we have enough rope to get him back.
We were talking about 60s
fetch
spy
television. Fetch the vacuum suck.
Right. I think that guy who was Grig in the last Star Trek has apparently been several things.
Yes, that guy. Oh, what was his name? I should remember this.
I promise there's a spy media podcast in here somewhere.
There
please,
you go.
Gentlemen.
That's Grig from Last Starfighter. That's the Predator's trainer in the Rocky versus Predator movie. Perfect.
Or you could just use Centauri from Last Starfighter if you want somebody with the sort of old man but looks human kind of.
No, but he's too sympathetic.
Oh, okay.
And then ultimately maybe the alien's trainer would have like a certain respect for his human adversaries, because Grig was kind of sentimental in the end, but he would be the perfect trainer.
It can't be worse than TKO. Okay,
no,
so
actually, it can't be. Back to the Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Like I said,
so,
yes, spy, we were in fact talking about
in here somewhere.
We were talking about a television show from the 1960s.
Now, if you look at, and we're probably going to be doing some more Man from U.N.C.L.E. episode reviews as season 2 goes on, but for the time being, we're thinking about the movie and we're thinking about the TV show, and do the two things line up? Now, there's a lot of cases where old movies are rebooted and books are adapted and source material is not respected and the corners don't line up. The puzzle pieces don't really fit. Although, I have to say, I really think that... Now, you look at Henry Cavill playing Solo in the movie and look at Armie Hammer playing Kuryakin in the movie, and they're tall, buff, muscular, like... They're probably genetically engineered. These guys are probably genetically engineered. But the guy Henry Cavill's playing in particular, I feel like he's really playing the same character that Robert Vaughn's playing.
I think Kuryakin in the show doesn't seem quite as wide, though, yeah. Just as large. I mean, he's a lot wirier. I mean, you know, he's in reasonably good shape, but he's not. I mean, in the movie, Kuryakin is
a tank.
Kind of a large
a guy
man.
That you could hit with a car and he would.
Yeah, what was so, waiting so, for so, me was barely human, I believe.
He
was
barely human. Now, even given that, I'm looking at the intensity McCallum's got out of his eyes in this show.
Yeah. No,
so other than the differences in size and shape, I really do feel like that Kuryakin from the movie could be this Kuryakin in the TV
show. You can definitely see where it kind of flows in from there. I kind of do see the criticism people leveled at the movie that, you know, they were kind of borrowing the thief shtick from some other media. You know, Solo's background, we don't really have a ton on in the show. So they felt they kind of gave Kuryakin his backstory of being, you know, slightly
deranged, psychotic, a sociopathic killer.
Anger issues.
There you go. That's right. Anger issues.
But, you know, and then for Solo, basically, you know, he's a not reformed thief, just a redirected thief, which, you know, is fine. That's, so, you know, I can see they wanted to give the audience, this is the media wasn't as well known. They wanted to give the audience who wasn't familiar with it a few hooks to kind of follow the characters with. But, I mean, overall, I mean, the performances between the Solo in the movie is a bit more glib. There's a bit more, you know, tongue in cheek. But, I mean, the overall movie likes to kind of wink at you. You know, there's, you know, I mean...
But not excessively.
No, not overall. Yeah, I mean, I can basically look at, you know, Robert Vaughn's performance and look at Henry Cavill's performance. And yeah, he's basically trying to kind of be that character. It's a little snappier, a little faster delivery. But
accounting for differences in production and standards, you know, and 40,
again, this
50
is
years.
The first time Robert Vaughn played the character. We haven't seen a lot
that's
of
true,
that.
That's true. That's one thing I like. I'd like to get a few more episodes under the belt. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're trying, the point here is, okay, first impression, side by side them. I'd like to get some later episodes, some color episodes under the belt. See, you know,
yeah.
Because it did apparently, as they say, go a little campy. You know, first you like something, then you love something, then you like seeing something that kind of
takes the piss a little bit.
A little bit, yeah.
And they apparently did all this in one TV show in the case of the
Mandalorian. They apparently went from fairly straight drama adventure in the first season to something kind of tongue-in-cheek in the second season to completely ridiculous in the third season, and then tried to rein it back in the fourth season but got canceled in November.
Mm. So really kind of like Buffy, only they did it in a much more compact framework.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly right.
Yeah, because that's the other thing. Again, much like Buffy and many other TV shows, as my friends will tell you, I have read extensively about shows that I've never actually seen, so I know stuff about
that's what the internet's muscle, for. What the internet's for.
But yeah, when I had heard about the whole involvement of somebody outside the spy world in The Man from U.N.C.L.E., it was described as they will just burst into the apartment of an uninvolved family and dunk their toaster in the sink because it's going to destroy the free world, and then disappear without anyone being the wiser. Whereas this was a bit, obviously, less comedic than that.
I really enjoyed it because, okay, I maintain this theory that there's not a man in the Western Hemisphere, and probably a substantial number of women, but I'm talking specifically about guys here. There's not a guy alive that does not actually believe deep in his heart that someday the American and or British governments are going to come to him and say, we need you to save the world. Every guy. Deep in his heart, whether he admits it or even realizes it. Every one of us thinks someday there's going to be an agent come through your door and say, Eric, we need you to save the world, and I'm going to be ready. Well, let's go. Let me get my coat. We all deeply believe that. Armageddon, the Bruce Willis Michael Bay movie from 1998, which I think is otherwise a completely regrettable movie.
I think it's probably the best Michael Bay movie I've seen.
Again, it's still deeply regrettable. The best Michael Bay movie is still deeply regrettable. I like Bad
Boys better.
Oh, wait, that's a Michael Bay movie.
The Rock is actually pretty good.
Okay, it's my third favorite Michael Bay movie.
And I only saw it the one time. In the summer of 1998. But I think there was a line in there where Bruce Willis says, gentlemen, the U.S. government needs us to save the world. And I genuinely believe that every guy in America, and maybe the entire hemisphere, really believes deep inside, dreams of the day, hopes for the moment where the government comes to you and says, we need you to save the world. Now, in my day job, I'm a substitute teacher. I'm probably where you're not going to need a substitute teacher to go save the world from anybody. But the day that happens, I'm ready. And hey, I think
Napoleon needed a housewife just because of who she dated in college.
Exactly. So. And boy, are we really hopeful that the government doesn't need us to go after the people we dated in college, some of whom might actually be listening to this. So, I hope some of you are listening to this. I hope you're listening to this. This is your kind of show. But anyway, so thumbs up on the movie from last year. Thumbs up also on the first episode of this TV show. And we do intend to cover more episodes of Man from U.N.C.L.E. and observe, and possibly even the reunion movie. And we're going to observe its rise, its disintegration, and then its brief, but, it won its time slot. It was a brief return to glory, but it did win its time slot, so there's that.
They did a Girl from U.N.C.L.E. at some point.
They did Girl from U.N.C.L.E. I think it was sometime during the third season.
During the third season. Okay.
During the third season, it starred
Stephanie Powers.
Stephanie Powers, also a name contributed by Ian Fleming, April Dancer, which is a Bond girl name if ever there was one.
Oh, definitely.
Now, for those of you interested in backstory, also according to the Wesley Britton book, apparently Sam Rolfe, in developing Man from U.N.C.L.E., developed literally an 80-page treatment, backstory, writer's bible about U.N.C.L.E., its structure, its headquarters, how it all worked. And even though a lot of that was not referenced in the television show, it was referenced in the tie-in novels. So for those, these of course the early 60s, the day the relative canonicity of media tie-in materials was not on anybody's radar. But if you're interested, you can certainly seek those out.
It's nice to have attention to detail so you don't get, even if you don't ever use it on screen, you've at least got...
The audience knows when you've thought about it.
Right, and that can show through you look at Star Trek, they kind of worked out roughly what part of the boards did.
Even
X,
what
y,
the buttons
Z.
did, yeah.
Right, so they were roughly, if they were doing a thing, they were roughly hitting the same set. And again, it wasn't, down to, that lever, this lever, or anything, but it was just, so it looks consistent. So if it's never referenced on screen... look at Pacific Rim. There's a ton of backstory and detail work in there that, you don't ever see, isn't ever referenced, but the production designers and the writers and such thought it through, and there's a verisimilitude to it that
you
contributes.
Can feel, that you can sense.
Or look at Star Trek II. They never referenced, any of the uniform guides or anything like that, the different color stuff, and, adherence to that was dodgy in later movies, but the costume designer, these are the different colors, and if you're in this, they're in engineering, they're going to be wearing this color, and these are the rank insignia, and then it made it feel that much more real.
I had a discussion similar to this with my dad a long while back. I was talking about something similar to this, and I don't even remember what it was, and he says to me, Eric, it's just a movie, for God's sake. And I say to him, Dad, the people who say to themselves it's just a movie are the same people that make Batman and Robin.
Ooh.
Yeah. That's
and he got it.
Yeah.
And he got it. He knew, I get it. And to my father's credit, he understood exactly what I meant.
if you're going to sell a world, if you're going to sell people, pull them in for a couple of hours and make them forget about everything and pull them in and make them feel they visited another place, then you
it
need that.
It has to be believable.
Yeah, you need that attention to detail. You don't need to barf it at people and give a giant long exposition of it.
In fact, it's probably better if you don't.
No, it's much better if you don't. We've watched some movies like GOG, G-O-G. Okay.
GOG.
It has really actually... very nice sets with very believable scientific equipment because it's all real scientific equipment. One of the Achilles heels of the movie is they explain what all that scientific equipment is and all the exhibits, and it's a little, they were a little too happy and too
excited.
They're
like, we rented this laboratory equipment and we're going to explain
And we're
going
to get every dime out of it we can.
I think the producers and directors were really genuinely fascinated by science and were, I think, trying to convey this is neat cutting edge stuff to the audience. But it kind of tends to make the thing slow down. Now, you compare Them, which is my absolute favorite atomic horror movie made in the United States. Okay. Because my favorite atomic horror movie is
Godzilla.
And Gorgo, which is my favorite made
English.
Over English, you know. And it's not, well, actually, Gorgo's just a giant monster movie. It's not an atomic horror movie.
That's true.
Just a giant monster. But my favorite...
Gorgo was atomic.
Nope, just a giant monster.
Good to know. Is Gamera atomic or is he just a giant monster?
Gamera is... I'm going to call Gamera an atomic monster because he's obviously driven by the power of the atom because he flies and spins and shoots fire. But Gorgo does not. Gorgo is just a... Gorgo, I think, is technically in the lineage from Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. But my favorite U.S. atomic horror movie is Them. And you've got the little slideshow PowerPoint these days, but slideshow of, how ant colonies work. It doesn't slow things down. And it feels at least vaguely plausible if, ants grew to gigantic size because of the power of the atom.
It really just has to be plausible while you're watching the movie.
Yeah, and it doesn't slow it down, even though you've got the little, basically, okay, Mr. Science now is going to explain science. So, the audience, understands a little bit about insect life, but it doesn't slow it down.
But that's also the exact kind of briefing that you would get somebody to do if giant ants were invading
wherever.
Exactly.
Now, what is the root word of briefing?
Brief.
Okay. So here's a brief summary of the things you need to know because the giant ants are currently eating the gate to the building. So, so that's kind of the thing. So, and you kind of see that you can look at movies like we watch a lot of 60s media and the pace of the story delivery and the pace of the cutting is, I don't want to say glacial, but it's slower.
It's noticeably different from contemporary productions.
Whereas you move forward to, it's just like boom, 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 boom. And it's like, on the far end, you can't get them to hold the damn camera still, and then you get into, we're going to do found footage. We watched Project Almanac last week, which was a perfectly entertaining movie, but it's all done found footage.
Nausea-inducing.
Yeah. Well, the other part also is a bit where...
it was pointlessly found. Well, no, they actually did have a reason for the footage being found, eventually.
But it was clearly being... this was also reported on the same device, but...
It was being recorded by multiple people on multiple different devices over the course
of
the
movie. And then the other part that kind of was like the... There's a point where all the characters are deaf... and you're hearing the ringing in their ears on the found footage. Mm. But the thing is...
Yeah, you want to maintain the consistency of your artifice.
So it was kind of... I liked it as an entertaining movie. It was okay. I mean, not surprisingly, it was made by MTV. I mean, that was MTV movies.
Didn't Michael Bay have a piece of Project Almanac?
He was one of three producers.
Yeah. So see, what we ought to do is every time the name Michael Bay comes up, we ought to do like they did with Frau Blücher and Young Frankenstein. Say the name
the
Michael
horse
Bay.
Winnie?
Michael Bay. No. It's being an explosion. Michael Bay.
Yeah. Well, you see.
Boom, mayhem.
Yeah,
that would work too. All right. So, is there anything else we need to say about the Pilot to Man from McCall? One cool thing. The Pilot to Man from McCall.
I didn't actually talk much about the episode.
Couple bits where you get to a certain point where there is the. And literally, gratuitous girl in a bikini.
Yeah.
Which,
unbelievably gratuitous.
It's a bikini from 1964, which was scandalous by 1964 standards, but.
Utterly demure by the standards of 2016.
Yeah, but. So,
okay, she is. You've heard the expression about Uncle Open Channel D. Mm-hmm. Well, she's apparently Channel D. She's like their live information uplink.
What would definitely be an AI or something in a movie made nowadays is that it's set 5 minutes in the future. There's literally a woman in an office at Uncle Headquarters who is Channel D.
It's kind of
sunning herself with a sun lamp and a bikini while she's on duty.
Now you talk about the lady at the front desk, on the secret base side of things. Yeah. Moneypenny
wouldn't let that.
But
chick
go down. She's not their Moneypenny.
No, she's
the girl
not.
In the bikini is their Moneypenny.
No, she's more like
Think about
it. Okay, fair, but I'm still gonna stick with Moneypenny would not have let that shit go down.
Well, no, but I'm saying is in terms of the character, like the Moneypenny character, the person.
She's the one that Agent flirts with. She's the one that has the information when you call in.
Right.
Fair point.
Right.
She's at least implied to be recurring. We've only seen the one episode, so we have no idea if she is.
But we're definitely going to be watching more of these and coming back to you.
Right. And also the fact, she's apparently doing her, she's apparently sitting in the communications watch and has a sun lamp going and is in the communications room in a bikini getting a tan. And Solo calls in. Provides his report and then tells her, turn off that sunlight before you cook or something. So Solo knows that she is prone to being in a bikini in the communications room on the night shift.
Uncle's a good outfit to work for.
So, again,
this is a good job. That's a good job.
There is a little bit of tongue in cheek. There is a little bit of tongue in cheek and wink.
Napoleon Solo flirts with at least two other women over the course of the movie as well. Yes, or show.
Although to his credit, he's not actually shown flirting with a married woman.
That's true.
Because this is 1960s television, after all. And there are certain
they develop something of a bond, and she appreciates the way that he sees her as opposed to the way her normal family sees her.
So I guess that's part of the fantasy of the show, is that everybody wants to break out of your daily life. What you perceive as the mundane quality of your daily life, you want to break out, have an adventure, see something different. But then the show also allows you that... The fantasy of the show allows you to break out of your mundane daily life, but also reassures you at the end that you're really just as happy doing your daily stuff anyway. She's very happy at the end of the show and thankful to go back to just picking up and cleaning up, and there's her husband and her kids. So in the end, she's very happy to go back to the mundane life that you presume the audience is in a hurry to escape.
Right. Now, admittedly, this comes off of nearly being parboiled alive by her former
boyfriend.
Yeah. So, yeah, I could see possibly, yes, the domestic life probably looks better than that by the darn sight. Again, as you mentioned, we were watching it. Okay, there are other podcasts for that. You can kind of probably write a nice small dissertation on exactly using this for comparative mores compared to 64 versus today. But there's another podcast out there somewhere. It's in iTunes. Go hunt that one down.
That's more their remit than it is ours. Now, the Man from U.N.C.L.E., the movie, does seem to reinforce one of the principal themes of the show. The Alicia Vikander character, who's just this car mechanic in East Germany, does get recruited into the spy world. And now, it turns out in the film, spoilers, I think most of the people listening to this show have probably already seen the movie, but Alicia Vikander in the movie turns out has already been turned by MI6 before the Americans and the Russians get to her. So technically, she's working for Uncle before there's an Uncle. But that still doesn't change the fact that she's just a regular person recruited into this crazy world, which is one of the principal themes of the show. So basically, for my part, it's thumbs up on the show. And I really do feel like some of the things we've noted here aside, I really do feel like you can believe that Henry Cavill and Armie Hammer are the same people played by Robert Vaughn and David McCallum.
Yeah, I'd want to see more of Kuryakin and even more of Solo before I'm definitely sure of that. Yeah. But I want to see more episodes.
Well, let's say our preliminary assessment.
Yeah, no, I think you could basically see, okay, after the Istanbul affair, then, they relocate back to New York. I could totally see this kind of flowing in to whatever out of the movie. I could totally...
Right.
Frankly, it would be... I really would almost love to see them take... I would love to see them almost reshoot the intro to this one with the characters from the movie.
Oh,
yeah.
That would be interesting. Because,
it's a nice little tight little shot, sequence and such. It does an excellent job of pulling the audience in. I'd love to see that updated with slightly more modern. I mean, they did a nice job on in the movie with the nice little montage sequence on the bass. So I'd like to see a retro 60s take on the show, which I don't think we're ever going to get unless everybody buys 5 copies of the Blu-ray.
And if you haven't, please, you don't have to be 5 copies of the Blu-ray. You can buy a Blu-ray, you can buy a DVD, you can get it on iTunes. There's at least 3 different ways you can buy it right now.
Yeah, but why would you? I guess you could buy it on. Well, actually, if you buy the Blu-ray, it comes with the DVD.
Yeah, but we're trying to gin up some profits here.
That's
we're trying
fair. To gin up some profits, I know, dude. But I'm just saying you want to get it on Blu-ray. It's a very beautifully shot movie. You don't want to shortchange the experience. It's very well shot.
It is beautiful.
I mean, I don't think the fact that it looks like it's shot on 60s film is...
Which is just a luxurious plus.
But back to, to this one, I could totally see this, the events of the movie flowing into this one very nicely. I would very much like to see how this kind of goes and unfolds, particularly, we looked at Mission Impossible and how it kind of changed from season 1 to season 2, and then you had the later seasons, you had the later but not so good seasons.
They've got the big 70s sideburns and the wide ties and the film stock's different.
And they're not going after international, that's the thing.
Mike Apollo. We're taking these guys and putting them after Mike Apollo.
And that's kind of about, the thing is, that's kind of about, I mean, that's really got to be like clubbing a baby seal.
Yeah, it kind of is.
As much as, the fact that, okay, the bad guys weren't the Soviets in Man from U.N.C.L.E., and, you know, kind of weren't the Soviets, give or take, in the Bond movies, though sometimes they were. There's something to be said to having an opposition who, you know, Mission Impossible lost a lot when it lost that frisson of, of pulled from the headlines.
Yeah.
Or at least just international espionage in general, yeah. when they kind of pulled back, and apparently we deal with organized crime now with our incredibly illegal...
Now, this one at least, I mean, if they're going up against Thrush, they pretty much sidestep that from the get-go. I don't know
Yeah, they've done much like James Bond with Spectre, that we've created an enemy acronym organization that is determined to rule the world but has no allegiance to any country.
Right, so that's...
Or like the Thresh Stooge says in the pilot episode, Thresh is my country.
Mm-hmm. Hail Hydra.
Hail Hydra. Cobra!
Right.
And let's be honest, and we look at... So they haven't really fleshed out Spectre in Dr. No or From Russia With Love. So really, you can kind of look at Thresh and say, Thresh may even be the prototype for the evil organization determined to rule the world, maybe even more than Spectre is.
They haven't really gotten to the Japanese fighting fish or whatever explanation yet.
Nope.
By the time that...
I think Thunderball, you pretty much get... Okay, this is the full unpacking of
Spectre. Right, Thunderball is a year later.
I can't remember the exact dates.
The novel would already have been out.
Right, and true. Remember that ill-fated dinner where everyone got snookered and nobody quite remembers who came up with what was, I think, before that. Remember, they're going to do Thunderball, they were going to do that as a movie first, and then that didn't quite pan out, and then they did it as a novel and then as a movie.
But remember, Joe Average comes home, watches Man from U.N.C.L.E. in 1964. He maybe doesn't know all these things that we know. This may be his first exposure to this kind of...
Be the earliest
named.
Yeah.
Neutral and yet obviously evil organization.
We need to, between now and the next time we do this, we need to basically figure, introduction of Spectre and mention of Spectre's, internals in the Bond novels and in the movies, and how much of Thresh we actually get over the course of the show. Because, this one, we know to nothing about Thresh.
Dr. No came out in 62, concurrent with Norman Felton's, according to Wesley Breton, concurrent with Norman Felton's original work on developing U.N.C.L.E. So that's in 1962.
He was making a spy show before the spy genre hit it really big.
Or concurrent with the premiere of Dr. No. I mean, Man from U.N.C.L.E. and Goldfinger hit more or less the same season. Not exactly the same time, but close. So the novel Dr. No wasn't working for Spectre. Mm-hmm. I don't think. We'll check
that. He was working for Smersh, I think.
He was working for, if he was working for anybody.
Right.
It may have been Smersh. So we're name checking Spectre and Dr. No in 1962, although that wasn't a huge part of the movie. I mean, just Dr. No down there in the Caribbean doing his thing. You don't start getting a hint of Spectre as Spectre until really Thunderball, where you get where Spectre, as most people think of it, is probably You Only Live Twice. With the guys in the... You don't really... I would argue that the public perception of Spectre is probably You Only Live Twice, with the volcano lair and the jumpsuits and...
Well, don't forget... I mean, the books were phenomenal. Let's not forget the books.
Yeah, but we all know what literacy rates are in the world. I mean, probably more people saw the TV show U.N.C.L.E. than ever read a James Bond novel.
Well, except... Okay, but this is the thing. How many tie novels were there for U.N.C.L.E.?
Quite a few, actually.
Okay. Over 20, on that shelf there...
According to Britain, 23 of them.
Okay, over on that shelf there are novelizations of Star Trek and Doctor Who episodes, because back before the VCR, if you wanted to relive your favorite TV episode, this was that really cool episode of Star Trek, you got the novelization. And if you wanted more of that, and then you would read the novel if you were a fan. And these were basically, particularly for the TV show novelizations, these were targeted mass markets, tying the same audience they'd use.
Fair point.
Get Smart had... novelizations,
and that kind of makes you a little... that's kind of weird to think of, isn't it?
It's weird for us now. Back then, the pocket paperback was basically your off-season tie-in media. That was your web. Cartoon series.
That was your way to relive that thing you really enjoyed so much.
Yeah. So and that was so... I don't want to discount that. Yeah, there was a good chunk of people that were fans of this. I think was there a comic book?
There was always... Yeah, there was a comic book.
And there's a Star Trek...
There was a comic
book. I know.
If there was, it was Gold Key.
Almost always.
Yeah, now the question was, Napoleon Solo or Ilya Kuryakin colored green in the comic?
That's a fair...
Oh, it was like the Star Trek comics had the characters just bizarre.
I think was it Spock was green? Bizarrely inappropriate.
I don't remember that. There's that, and I don't know if it came from one of the comic series or it was just completely original, but there was that one of those book and record series where Maress, who is at least supposed to be an alien, but was some kind of blue woman. Uhura was blonde and white, and Sulu was black.
And now we've gone from that. Now there's actually a whole subunit of Lucasfilm dedicated to making sure the books and the comics and the games and everything fits. There are people whose job it is to make sure the Star Wars book you buy for your kid not only does not conflict, but ties in efficiently with the movie you take him to see. That's people's whole jobs these days.
The whole licensing tie-in thing didn't really, become huge. They didn't realize what a cash cow that could be until Star Wars. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, okay, there's money involved.
There was always merchandising. They sold a crap ton of Tunkle toys, comics, records, Teen Beat magazines with dreaming pictures of David McCallum. There's always been merchandising, but I do think you got a fair point in that people didn't realize the bonanza. Star Wars really did set a gold standard for merchandise.
Full potential. And again, Star Wars,
that's a fair point.
Okay, Star Wars was big, so therefore Star Wars merchandising was big. But I think the ability of the tie-in merchandising to become a gigantic
empire all in its own.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean,
see what I did there?
There was probably merchandising, but probably they didn't make as much on the merchandising necessarily as they necessarily made on, selling the ad spots and the other stuff. So yeah. I'm just, that was, and then who owns that stream and all that other stuff the potential there, again, I think Star Wars was the event where they realized, oh my lord, we do this right with the right property, we can make more on that than we made on the movie. And the movie made a little money. Yeah.
Well, maybe that's why in the late 70s and early 80s, you end up with relatively obscure toy lines getting Marvel comic series that last longer than the toys.
Visionaries, we're looking at you.
Well, Micronauts and ROM.
Those as well.
Well, I think part of the reason those lasted longer, and let's not forget G.I. Joe, which I think the comic ran longer than the first run of the cartoon. Probably.
The comic ran much longer than the first run of the cartoon. I think the comic and the toy line wrapped up about the same time.
But part of the reason ROM was so successful, I think, was just
the writing was really good.
It was really well written.
You might say that Bill Mantlo was performing way above expectations.
I commented about this earlier. I think I discovered some old comics in box when I was looking through stuff, and I was like, oh yeah, I read this episode. Yeah, this issue of I think it was Alpha Flight or whatnot. I really liked that one. I just bought it because it looked cool and it had a great story. And then there was this issue of ROM, and they were both written by Bill Mantlo at the same time.
Yeah.
So
I hate what happened to him. Yeah. Gotta hate that. Yeah. For those of you who do not also follow comics, although I'm sure some of you do. For those of you who don't follow comics, Bill Mantlo was a Marvel Comics writer all through the 70s and the 80s and into the early 90s, a man of remarkably prolific and remarkably talented at his work, who was riding his bicycle and hit by a car and has been in an assisted living facility for most of the last 20-some-odd years, which is a terrible shame, not just on general principle, but because the man was also a gifted writer, unable, hence, to pursue his gift.
If you love Rocket Raccoon, you love Bill Mantlo's work.
Period. End of story.
That was where I first came across his name specifically, was that they were making sure that he got to see Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah. So, it was just, I had never connected that name with that, a bunch of the comics I really liked when I was, when I was reading comics and wasn't paying that close attention to who the heck was writing them or drawing or such. Mm-hmm. It was all the same guy.
ROM, he did runs, basically he wrote at one point or another everything Marvel. He had a hand in virtually everything over there, and it's a terrible damn shame what happened to him.
Well, my thinking was particularly not just that Marvel would then go on to make really good comics out of these properties, but that they would get licensed for cross-promotion in the first place.
Well, I think
nowadays, I don't think an obscure, not already based on some other property toy line, especially one toy, which is what ROM was, there was never even a
line.
It wasn't even a great toy. It turned out it kind of sucked. I wanted it when I was that young.
I had one. It was fun enough, but yeah,
it was fun enough for about 5 minutes, and then you got bored with it, like everybody else did.
I had three different gadgets.
I played with mine to the point of destruction, but possibly...
I got bored after about 5 minutes.
Then again, I thought Iron Man was cool before most people had heard of Tony Stark, and I've kind of, mechanical suits that shoot beams and blow things up has kind of been something I've liked for longer is healthy.
It's in your wheelhouse. That's your wheelhouse.
Yeah, so mine pretty much, mine finally stopped working.
Well, and likewise, actually, come to think of it, since I've been looking into the early Star Wars comics and stuff as well, before Star Wars was Star Wars, the phenomenon, they managed to shop that to Marvel Comics as well. I mean, that turned out really well for them, obviously.
It also got a newspaper strip.
That's true.
Now, in a way, Man from U.N.C.L.E. was kind of prefiguring a lot of this.
Though there was a Bond, newspaper strip, wasn't
there? Yeah, it turns out.
That ran for a good long while. So one of the significant things about Man from U.N.C.L.E. is it was a big part of this kind of tendency to build a merchandising empire about something. The guy that produced, again, according to the Wesley Britton book, the guy that produced U.N.C.L.E. was keenly aware of this kind of thing. He was aware of the potential of merchandising there in the mid-60s and profited very well by it. So he knew all this stuff was available. I mean, technically, I mean, there was kind of Star Wars did kind of signal a sea change and how seriously these things were taken and how they were managed and how they were exploited. But you start looking at classic examples like Superman and Batman, Bugs Bunny, Popeye. There are people who are collecting sort of Superman tchotchkes and memorabilia going back literally to like probably the day after he was published. Uncle definitely took advantage of all this stuff.
There was a comic book story not very long into the run of Superman about a guy that just wanted to sell Superman merchandise.
Yeah, there you go. All right. So one cool thing. So technically what we're trying to get at here is the space between the movie and the TV show. So this interesting crossover, this interesting, fairly unique crossover, what's one cool thing between the movie and the show? Some connection, or maybe just one cool thing about the show?
I found the intro just, again, absolutely just bam, pulled me right in. Even if I hadn't seen this before, I would have been like, or, you know, seeing the movie, I would have been like, okay, I need to see what's going on here. This is kind of cool. Where does this go? Who is this guy? Who are these other guys? Why are they shooting at each other? It's just nicely shot, and it does the perfect job of making you want to see the rest of it. Just like kind of like the credits to Mission Impossible. Like, why is Jim Phelps in a monk's robe running down the street? You know, you have to know more.
With wheels of cheese.
Right, exactly. So I thought that was just really cool. That was just really, I mean, that was just very slick, very sharp, very nicely edited.
Stacey, one cool thing.
I guess I like the way that they gave some depth to the guest star, the recruit, and the way that they just set that up, that there's apparently one person in the world that might be able to get close enough to this guy in the time that we have.
And it's you. Yes. Yeah, cool. I'm gonna second both of those, and I'm going to say the music again. Because an integral part of a lot of the spy entertainments that we report on here, the music is an important part of that presentation. The themes to Man from U.N.C.L.E. were done by the late, great Jerry Goldsmith, legendary composer for film and television. You've heard his music. Check him on IMDb. His music sounds like the movies. And anything he happened to do the score for, it always lent it an extra air of excitement and emotion and cool. And it's no different here. He composed the classic U.N.C.L.E. theme and then the music for the series. Or I assume the series. He was name-checked in the opening episode anyway, and given their tendency to reuse music clips, probably a big hunk of the show.
There was one bit, actually, y'all both commented on while we were watching it, right at the end, where the housewife is, you know, getting off the plane and going back to her you know, family at the airport, and Solo is just apparently taking their turn flight, so he's just on there watching out the window as she goes back to her family, and he's just sort of almost wondering, you know, the life that could have been, you know, there for just, you know, a little bit, just, you know, almost wistfully looking out there and just sort of wondering, and then the stewardess comes along. It's not exactly the mask goes back on, but he's, you know, back to being international man of mystery and spy. Yeah. And
what can you, beautiful stewardess, do for me before we take off?
But that got me to thinking of that episode, you know, the bit in right at the end of Wheels with the character played by Martin Landau.
Oh, yes.
The civilian played by Martin Landau.
Right.
Actually being, you know,
The one Rollins doubling.
Right, exactly. And, you know, and Cinnamon, and just, you know, that little wistful moment there, and that brief of, well, this is what it must be like to not be shot at every day and basically have to, you know, worry about being followed and run off the road to work in the morning. You know, I just thought that was kind of neat. Just for, you know, that one little, and for a show that's about the normal person getting pulled into the world of espionage, you know, is there a slight hint that the people in the world of espionage might possibly at some point just wish for, you know, their dream job is, I just get up, go to work, have a family, don't get shot at.
Yeah, I like that too. All right, cool. We'll be doing more with Man from U.N.C.L.E. as season 2 goes on. Thank you very much for listening to us. We love this material, and it's a great pleasure for all of us to share our enthusiasm and the things we find out about it with you. Ray, if you'll name check your email address.
It's ray@agentsof.cool.
Stacey?
I'm Mrs. Peel, MRSPEEL, no period, at agentsof.cool.
I'm number 6, all one word, number 6@agentsof.cool. You can find us on the web at agentsof.cool. You can find us on Twitter at
agentsofcool.
So if you have any feedback, anything you want to share, anything you'd like us to cover, yeah, please, please feel free to get in touch with us. Thank you for listening, and we'll catch you next time. We'll be right back.
Oh, yeah, the date?
Yes. Yeah, okay. So, no, we are indeed recording. I just wanted
did that sound good? Should I do another one? I'm trying to do the Grindhouse trailer voice.
You're going to need to gargle motor oil and become Vin Diesel.
Well, closer. Well, let me try it one more time.
Agents of Cool, Season 2, in color.
Okay, that was good. That was okay. Good. Okay,
sounds at least like the G.I. Joe announcer guy, so that's...
Well, okay, that's... Well, there you go. That's,
all right, that's good. That works,
I mean,
too.
Yeah, that's...
Okay, one more time, because I enjoy that.
Agents of Cool, Season 2, in color.
Okay, that's good.
All right, so shall we begin?
Well,
let's get started. Welcome back to Season Tool, Agent... Season Tool. Jesus Christ.
Okay, when you said you were going to do the Grindhouse version, I didn't know... Whoa, okay, I'm not sure this is the...
We do try to keep this a family show, after all, more or less.
We're going to need more than the explicit tag for this one, man.
Right, let's try one more time.